Welcome to After Hours at the Radio Book Club. It is a podcast, a collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU, Arsene Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore, as always, is my co-host. And in After Hours, we delve into some more conversation with our featured author. And today we are delighted to have Tiari Jones join us. And we're talking about her new book, An American Marriage. Now, in the regular book club edition, we got into a lot of the history behind the book and your idea to really explore mass incarceration, but the impact on relationships. And it was interesting that, well, it wasn't interesting, but, you know, it's so typical that it was the male who is incarcerated, and then you're dealing with the woman who is left to make the decision, am I going to stay in this relationship? I wonder what would happen if the gender was flipped, if it was a woman who was incarcerated, because I know the original premise of this, you overheard a conversation in a shopping mall where a woman was said to a man, you wouldn't have waited, or he said to her, you wouldn't have waited for me. But what is the reality around that? I mean, are there statistics about women who are incarcerated and relationships that are left behind?
She says, Roy, you know you wouldn't have waited on me. And he says, I don't know what you're talking about. This wouldn't have happened to you in the first place. Actually, there is not very much research at all on women who are incarcerated, which is really, I mean, there's some people in American studies who are studying it, but mostly most of the research on incarceration has to do with men, and men are incarcerated much higher number. But I mean, this is anecdotal, but if you go to a men's prison, women arrive in buses of women. And if you go to a women's prison, there are not nearly as many visitors, and the visitors are almost all women. They're their mothers, their sisters. Women are the caretakers of incarcerated people.
And women are the ones who are leading, or women are the ones who are also paying the sentence, I suppose, when their loved one is incarcerated, because in many instances, if they're waiting for their partner, I mean, the collateral damage of incarceration, when you look at the partners who are left behind, the children,
the partners or children, and, you know, most women in prison, since you brought them up, most women in prison have children, and those children are usually being reared by their mothers, by the mother of the grandmother of the children. Women care for incarcerated people. I mean, women are the caretakers in society, and I'm sure there are men out there who, you know, take care of families when women are incarcerated, but it's far more likely that the woman is being cared for by her female relatives. So this question of reciprocity that comes up between Celestial and Roy, it's such an interesting thing, because she's asking him, what if the tables were turned? And he's saying, that table doesn't even turn. I don't even get why we're talking about this. It's almost like she's asking him about, well, what would happen if this was on Mars? You know, so he can't even engage the question. And for me, I was torn for both of them, because what is it to ask something of someone when you know there would not be reciprocity? But is the question of reciprocity, is it a valid question when it wouldn't happen?
Especially the wrongful incarceration.
Wrongful, rightful, if there even is a such thing as rightful. Like, I was so torn. I mean, I chose to make him wrongfully incarcerated, because I didn't want it to be whether or not he deserves to be in prison, and what she should she use their relationship to further punish him for his crime. I didn't want to engage that. But at the end of the day, there are a lot of people who are given very lengthy prison sentences for fairly small crimes. Mm-hmm. So the question for them would be the same. Like, let's say you're in jail on some drug charge, right? And you're given 20 years because it's your third strike. I mean, the question is still the same. A person doesn't deserve to lose 20 years of their life because of a drug charge. So even though they technically are not wrongfully incarcerated, the way they are incarcerated is wrongful.
I mean, I think it would be interesting to know how many people are in jail on marijuana charges right now, where there's
exactly
states like Colorado and California where it's legal.
Well, there was that ruling recently that they're going to exonerate some of the folks that were serving time, but there are many people who've lost many, many years of their lives, yeah, for laws that are no longer on the books.
And you cannot get your anything. When you get released, you can't get your time back. That's the thing that is lost forever. Even if you're given money from the government to apologize for what has happened. And most people don't. I mean, Roy, when Roy is released, he's shocked. He just knew he would walk out of the front door. He says, I thought I would walk out of the front door. I imagine myself walking down a marble staircase and I would find my family waiting. But even though he is released because his conviction was overturned, he leaves out the back door through the back by the garbage cans like everyone else.
And with $23? $23. Right. Yeah. You know, in the book, the city of Atlanta is a character. You know, there's a lot going on in Atlanta. That's where Celestial was raised, and that's where the marriage is, and that's where Andre was raised. I thought there was a few interesting things about the racial history of that city, though. It's mentioned in passing, the freeway cutting through the African-American neighborhood there, which really decimated that community. The Atlanta child murders are also mentioned in the book at one point. Andre, I think, mentions it in one of his parts. What did that history mean to you and kind of bringing some of those things into the book?
Well, I'm born and raised in Atlanta. I graduated from Spelman College like Celestial did. Atlanta is my natural habitat. I am at home only when I am there. And I live in New York now. I live in Brooklyn. And when I tell people in Brooklyn that I'm from Georgia, they act like I got here on the Underground Railroad. They're just like, wow, how was that? And Atlanta, to me, is just a magical city. And I see it as a city with a lot of opportunities for African Americans. And people associate the South with poverty and a lack of opportunity. But in Atlanta, there are so many Black institutions. I mean, I grew up, I never had a white doctor when I was growing up. And this is a Black true story. I went to visit an elderly friend in her 80s, and I needed to go to a doctor because I had a little bit of a cold and it wasn't going away. And she said, I have a doctor. She said, he's good. She hesitated. And she says, he didn't graduate from Morehouse College, but he went to Harvard, and it's only a cold. He won't kill you. And Atlanta is a place where Black people have that kind of pride, where we look down on people who went to Harvard. And I really wanted to capture that also part of Atlanta. So yes, the freeway did cut Sweet Auburn Avenue in half and decimated that community. But there is also, you know, Black prosperity there. And being set in Atlanta also gave me a lot of room to look at tensions within the racial group, class, for example, in Atlanta, because people do not have the struggles with the same kind of in-your-face racism that makes everyone, I feel like in-your-face racism makes Black people bond more across lines. Like, you don't have the luxury of nuance when you're facing certain kinds of challenges. But in Atlanta, when there's not that same kind of pressure cooker environment, then you can really look at class, you can look at gender, you can look at a lot of different things. So I think this novel is really an intersectional look at Black Atlanta.
I thought the class discussion was really interesting because I think that was always something in the back of Roy's mind, because he grew up in Louisiana in very modest circumstances, but Celestial grew up in a very well-to-do area. As we said, her dad was a self-made millionaire. He's an inventor. So it was a very bohemian family and a completely different experience coming from Roy, who came from quite a rural background.
Yes. I mean, he comes from a rural background, and she keeps saying, you know, my dad didn't always have this money. My dad is literally the son of sharecroppers. And Roy says, you know, well, your daddy ain't sharing no crops now. But, you know, she did grow up in a family with some money, but they are only one generation removed from abject poverty. So she doesn't, it's not like she's, you know, from the Vanderbilt family, just one generation.
Yeah. Well, and that's one of the lessons, you know. Roy, who came from this rural background and now he's becoming more of a professional, graduated college, the whole thing. And then he's incarcerated, and that can easily set somebody back, you know, if you're only one generation removed and you don't have all those resources, and it can be taken so quickly. In his case, you know, it doesn't quite work out exactly that way, but it still felt fragile to some extent.
Yes, he felt like you know, his mother felt like all she wanted to do was get her son in college without him, what his mother says, without getting anyone pregnant and without going to jail. And she gets that, and it almost feels like it was fate, like it just the fate or the, or like the reality of small town Louisiana just rose up and snatched him when he thought he was free. But, you know, and he gets, and he says to Andre, you know, he thinks, he says, Andre, you think you're better than me, but this could have happened to you just like it happened to me. And Andre says, you think I don't know this? I've been black my whole life. So the specter of the specter of the state, the specter of prison coming to snatch you away from your life is always there. But I do think that for middle and upper class people, it's less likely to happen, but it's always there in your peripheral vision. But I don't mean to suggest for one second that the fear of it is the same for, it's the same reality. I mean, if you look at Philando Castile, who was killed by the police in Minneapolis, they said that man had been stopped by the police 148 times or something like that. So his situation is very different than, say, Henry Louis Gates, who was arrested at his own home. But, you know, Gates was humiliated. Gates was, you know, demeaned, but Castile is dead. Michael Brown is dead. Class makes a significant difference, but still that the fear, the dread is always there.
And it is brought up to a certain degree after Roy is released, and there's a confrontation that turns kind of violent, and at one point Celestial comes
kind
out.
Kind of violent?
Turns violent. Okay, it turns violent. But Celestial comes out and wields a phone almost like a gun to say, I'm going to call the police, because everybody knows what that call would do. One being that Roy has just been released from jail, but also that it's two black men having a fight, and if the police were to come upon that, who knows what could happen.
Yes, and but she's so afraid because the fight has turned so violent. So will this call save a life or cost a life? She doesn't know, and she has to make a decision in a moment. Originally, I had chosen to end the book there with that decision.
Oh, I'm so glad you didn't.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, me too. Me three. But that's where I was stranded all that time. I knew it wasn't the end. It felt like an end, though, because that is a moment mm-hmm. when she has the power to just dial 911 and perhaps send Roy back to prison or who knows what. But I just did not want to end it giving the state all after all Roy has been through, after all I've been through writing it. I could not hand this narrative over to the state.
We haven't talked that much about Andre, because Andre is the third character whose perspective the story is written from. And he and Celestial, they're childhood friends. They grow up as neighbors and
go to the prom
together. They go to the prom together. You know,
they post prom together.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. But all
you
of this.
You find out when his narrative. So at the beginning of the book, you're alternating between Roy and Celestial. Then you have the letters. And then it's afterwards that you start getting Andre's chapters, his point of view. And you find out that Andre, who first is introduced as this really good friend who introduced Roy and Celestial originally, you come to find out that he has loved her his whole life.
His whole life. You know, and it sometimes people get mad about the Celestial-Andre plot. But, I mean, I feel like Roy's incarceration makes everything in their lives so much more fraught. The idea that you find love with the boy next door is a completely accepted, certified romantic trope. Like, that is the boy next door. That's, like, if you say someone is the boy next door, you think they're supposed to get married. Like, that's a thing. But for Celestial and Andre, because of Roy's incarceration, I think Celestial's father says, you had your whole life to marry her if you wanted to. Like, everything is so fraught that they can't even participate easily in that old narrative.
Well, they're accused of it being convenient. I think her mother says that to her. Her mother says, is he just convenient?
Yes, and he says love is supposed to be convenient. It's supposed to be convenient. That's a plus. That's not a bug. It's a feature.
Well, that was the interesting thing is their love is easier, and I mean that in a good way. Their love, they're comfortable, they're together, where Roy and Celestial, even before the incarceration, there's a lot of passion there, but there's also butting heads that they do have struggles in different ways, which can be rewarding, but if you're going to be married for the long haul, that can be tough.
But you know, we never know. Yes, Celestial and Roy are a little breakup to make up you know, in the beginning. And he's a little bit of a cheater, not a lot of a cheater, but a little bit of a cheater. But we don't know if over time that would have simmered down, because they only get 18 months. And we just don't know. Like, that's the thing about this marriage. We just don't know what would have happened. The intervention of the incarceration, it just stacks the deck against them. They would have need to have a superhuman love to weather this storm without major upheaval. And it's too much to ask, I think.
Especially with the boy next door.
Yes, but then when Roy shows back up, you know, when I was originally writing it, I had Celestia a little more indifferent to him when he shows back up. But I was in Atlanta, and I was in the Starbucks over by my parents' house, and I saw this guy I used to like in elementary school. Elementary school, that is over. And my heart leapt. And I said, okay, if I'm responding like this to my fifth grade crush, certainly when Celestial sees Roy again, her husband, she is going to react. So that really, those little things kind of, that's what happens when you write a novel. Everything that happens in your real life, you start thinking, well, then how does that affect the book?
Mm-hmm. In terms of the physicality of the characters, you do talk about how they're physically changed, because of course Roy changes, he's incarcerated, and you talk about that, but also Celestial changes too. I mean, did you really want to kind of have that as a part of, okay, the narrative, time has moved on, so I need to describe how physically these characters are different?
Yes, time has changed, and you know, Celestial, you know, women are not rewarded for aging, even though she's still fairly young. She's what, like 32, 33 when he gets out. But she's not the lithe young girl that he knew before. She has a woman's body now. And that is something, too, that he has to adjust. When he sees her assistant, he thinks his her assistant is her. And he realized that, no, she can't still be that young. The girl that I'm looking at is like my imagination of Celestial. But she's older now. She doesn't have the long hair anymore because it's a hassle. She has her hair cut short. Everything is different. They live different lives, and they live these different lives in different bodies.
In terms of the reaction that you're getting to the book, you said that, you know, there are people who are threatening to show up with Team Roy or Team Andre t-shirts to book signings and stuff. But, you know, the broader narrative around mass incarceration, the collateral damage, the relationships that are lost due to all of this. I mean, what are you hearing back from readers?
I'm hearing a lot of people, when I write a novel, I have two goals. One goal is for people who have experiences that are parallel to that of the story to feel seen, to feel understood, to feel comforted. So that's one goal. And the second goal for me is for people who have not experienced this to think about it. And those, it's a tightrope to make a story that's satisfying both to people who know and people who don't. Or someone said, people who don't know and people who need to know. And that was a really challenging thing. But it has been rewarded to meet people who say that the experience reflects something that happened to them. And I've discovered that there are women that I know in my professional life who never told me that they have a loved one who's incarcerated. And the incredible guilt they felt about living their lives. Because the woman who is ride or die, as the expression goes, it's so idealized in the culture that there's so many ways women are made to feel inadequate, I think. And I think so. I think that was helpful. And also, I have a friend who was incarcerated as a teenager, and he wrote me a very moving letter about his experience reading the book. And he was there are two people who I was fearful about reading the book. One was him, since he would have a certain authority about the subject that I could not have since I was using imagination. And so when he kind of gave me a check off on it. And the other one is a woman I know who works for the Innocence Project, and she has a loved one who's incarcerated. I was so worried that she would tell me that the book wasn't Innocence Project-y enough, like it wasn't enough on the nose about litigating the issues. But she also approved of it, and she said that what she liked about it was that the people's lives are more than their predicaments. And I felt really satisfied. That call from her was honestly as satisfying as the call from Oprah.
Wow. Well, you know, it to get that insider thing, I think a lot of writers deal with that in a lot of different ways. We've talked to other writers who are nervous about a few people or a few, you know, and to get it right and to try to get that okay from people is important. And I think that's, as somebody who maybe needs to know or doesn't know, and you're, you know, I felt on that side of it, you did an amazing job. You know, I was with you the whole time. And so it's kind of, you know, I'm not surprised to hear that you're, people who have experienced things like this are giving you praise as well, because it rang so true. And I think that's why when I told you I thought I loved the ending so much, is you have a real truth, a real honesty in how you dealt with these characters as full people that I think is rare, and it was really beautiful.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you. Tiari Jones has been our guest after hours at the Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. Arsene Kashkashian, my co-host, as always, with the Boulder Bookstore, and I'm Maeve Conran.